The views expressed on this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware. Welcome to the Music Room on WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark. Each week, WVUD hosts different artists to talk about the music they play and the lives they lead. Stay tuned for the Music Room on WVUD.
Well, good evening, everybody. Mando Richard here, and welcome to the Music Room here on WVUD. Tonight, we've got an interview with a bassist that three of us from WVUD saw up in Philadelphia last month. Mappa Elliott with his quartet, Mostly Other People Do the Killing, with John Irabagon on the sax, Ron Sabinski on the piano, Mappa himself on the bass, and Kevin Shea on the drums. While we're getting Mappa on the line, we're going to listen to Mostly Other People Do the Killing do a song that they call Bird in Hand from their 2012 release, Red Hot. If all goes well, after this tune, you're going to hear from Mappa Elliott. This is the Music Room on WVUD. If I pushed all the buttons right, Mappa Elliott has joined us. Good evening, Mappa.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing just fine. Well, we just heard Bird in Hand from your Red Hot CD. Tell us about that.
About that tune?
Sure.
Well, that was one of the first tunes that I wrote for the expanded seven-piece version of the band. And it's just kind of like lively and up-tempo, and used it as a feature for John Irabagon to play soprano. And in planning that version of the band, I was really interested in kind of 1920s and 1930s instrumentation. So on that entire record, John Irabagon, the saxophone player, only plays soprano in honor of Sidney Bechet,
or
C melody saxophone in honor of Frankie Trumbauer.
You know, you were saying those magic words, in honor of. And I think one of the things that I just loved when we saw you live up in Philadelphia a couple of weeks ago was you guys definitely do homage to the jazz that came before. But it's not like you're doing a funeral mass or a staid testimonial dinner. Man, you're roasting the heck out of it.
I mean, you know, I think that the where we are with, you know, music at this point in the 21st century, there's, you know, so much history behind us that's so accessible that, you know, I mean, any music that anybody makes is going to inevitably be a conversation with history at this point. So, yeah, I mean, that Red Hot album is maybe more explicitly a conversation with a very definitive part of history than some of our other stuff. But, yeah, I mean, our way of interacting with the historical material is, you know, this is the stuff that we listen to and love and have been, you know, obsessed with our entire lives. But you only get, you know, 60 minutes or so on an album or in a given set. And so when you try and cram everything you can think of into 60 minutes, it gets rather dense.
I think when we saw you, you did a cover of Dave Holland's Obelisk.
And in the... no, not a cover. I stole the title and the vibe. But that's my tune.
Very good. Well, my most humble apologies.
My apologies to Dave Holland. But,
but in the middle of this amazing thing that was where the idea and the vibe is taken from his work, all of a sudden you were quoting, or John was quoting, Yakety Sax. And all of a sudden, somebody else was quoting.
That song shows up every once in a while in our sets. There are a couple of, on some of the earlier records, I wrote a couple of little, like, kind of two-beat kind of things that, depending on which way we take it, can kind of veer into Yakety Sax territory. And so kind of whenever anybody in the band throws that out, we kind of know that that's one of the possible places it could be going. And, I don't think we actually played the Yakety Sax. I think John just played the Yakety Sax over the top of whatever else was going
on. Exactly right. He just did the phrase. That has been known to happen. It was a whole lot of fun. I mean, just you guys were quoting from all sorts of different kinds of things. It was just really just a joyous concert, and I think that's what comes through. Now, you've been at this for quite some time. You and Peter Evans, the trumpet player who's recently gone off on his own, you guys met back in college at Oberlin.
Yeah, Peter was, I think, 2 years behind me in school, but I stayed an extra year to play as a musician in Cleveland, Ohio for a while. By the time I was graduating from school, I was playing a lot of straight-ahead jazz gigs in Cleveland and having a good time, so I stuck around an extra year. So, yeah, Peter and I were in school together for 3 years and lived together for one of those years. And, yeah, so we've known each other, you know, for a good long time at this point.
And it's really, I get the sense that you and John Irabagon and Kevin Shea and Peter at the time and now Ron Stabinski on the piano, that you guys really enjoy playing with each other, and it just shows in everything you do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, music is a very social thing, and, you know, the kind of people that I like to play music with are people that have, like, a really, really thorough, deep knowledge of music history, but then also an ability to kind of jump around within all of that stuff rapidly. And so, yeah, you know, I kind of gravitate towards people that have, like, a similar perspective. And so, you know, we're all these musical omnivores who, you know, when we're driving to gigs, we're playing, you know, Coltrane and Sun Ra 1 minute, and then Marvin Gaye the next minute, and then James Brown the next minute, and then Paul Whiteman the next minute, and, you know, Duke Ellington, like, all over the map as we can be, and really enjoying all of it so that it all comes out, you know, when we play together.
Well, all of your technique is just wonderful. Me as a bass player, but nowhere as good as you, sir. We're just amazed watching you use both thumbs to sort of make bars on different parts of the fingerboard and using your fingers underneath. You were just all over that neck.
Yeah, I mean, Peter and I, when we were in school, got interested in a lot of kind of non-jazz improvised music as well as jazz improvised music, and so lots of us here in New York and several people in Philadelphia that I'm aware of have been experimenting with, you know, playing solo form music, you know, like entire sets or entire albums or entire concert performances of solo instrumental music. And one thing that unites everybody who's doing that is this, you know, desire to kind of explore the sonic possibilities of your instrument. And so I've kind of tried to find as many ways as I can to play the bass in a very, like, polyphonic way, you know, having more than one or two things happening at any given time. And that kind of forces you to do a lot of strange acrobatics with your hands in order to, you know, facilitate that happening. But, you know, there are a lot of people doing that, and I think it's great, and it's you know, I'm always excited whenever I hear, you know, other people, you know, working on solo material and trying to explore more of what their instrument can do.
But it's you guys, and, you know, in some ways you reminded me of the ICP Orchestra, the Instant Composers Pool Orchestra, in that you
we've gotten that before.
It's like you guys, you're both pushing the envelope, but you've got the chops. It's not just you're saying, look, I'm going to make some strange noises with my instruments. You know, you push the edge, but then you go back to the historic roots, if you will, and it all comes together.
We hope so. Sometimes it doesn't, but that's okay.
Hey, it's all about improvisation, you know?
Yep.
Now, I know, because, you know, I've looked it up, and you're probably sick of this question, but you better tell the listening audience down here in Delaware where that name, Mostly Other People Do the Killing, came from.
Sure, why not? So when I was in school, we had to read a paper for an electronic music history class I was taking, and it was a paper on the scientist and musician and inventor Leon Theremin, who is a Russian scientist who, born in the late 1800s, lived until the 1980s, I believe. And he invented the instrument, the theremin, which is the first electronic instrument anybody came up with, and it's the one that you play without touching it. You kind of wave your hands around it, and it makes eerie sounds. And so he invented this instrument, and then, you know, a decade or two later, he invented it in the teens. And in the 30s, Stalin had him kind of disappeared and thrown into the gulag, where he built spy equipment for decades, and everybody thought he was dead. And then in the early 80s, as an old man, he showed up at an electronic music convention in New York. And during the interview, he was asked what he thought of Stalin, and his response, which was, you know, very diplomatic Russian response, was that Stalin wasn't so bad because mostly other people did all the killing. And I kind of underlined that and, you know, decided that, like, I liked the way those words went together. And so that became the band name.
Forgive me for laughing, but that's cool.
That's wonderful. Some dark Russian humor right there.
And it forced me to go look up the theremin. It's like totally bizarre. These two things sticking up that look like aerials, and you change the pitch and the volume by moving your hands, but you better not touch it.
Yeah. No, it's great. There are improvising theremin players out there that I'm aware of, and it's had a long and illustrious career. It gets, you know, there's a Charles Ives symphony that uses one. There's music by Olivier Messiaen, a French composer, that uses the keyboard version. It's in Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys. It's in the soundtrack to, like, you know, dozens, if not hundreds, of Hollywood B-movie sci-fi trash. It's great.
Well, let's get back to some of your more recent recordings. Over in Europe, I believe it's available in America, too. There's a release of a concert that you did in Hanover, Germany, that's available.
Very recently available.
Right. That includes things like A Night in Tunisia, but all sorts of other things that helps people understand why some reviewers refer to your music as terrorist bebop.
We're really excited about that record. That's the last record, the last released performance of Peter Evans, the trumpet player, playing with the band, and it was from a tour we did almost exactly a year ago. And Yeah, we got a really great recording of what happened to be a really great live show. And, you know, luckily we got somebody who was interested in putting it out. So I'm really happy about that as like a great kind of like final document of Peter and the band, because, you know, like that was, you know, one of our more energetic performances ever. And it's you know, I'm glad that that's something people are going to be able to listen to.
Oh, great. Now, the other release that you put out just before that, last year, was one that some critics are scratching their heads about. It's
Yes, I don't know if anyone's actually scratching their head about it. But
well, it's called Blue, and it's the ultimate tribute to Miles Davis.
It is.
Are you going to go further there? This is live radio, brother.
I mean, sure. Yeah, no. I mean, I've been thinking about that record for the better part of a decade, so I could talk about that for several hours straight without losing it. So what are you interested about talking about as far as that record? And for those of you listening who don't know, what we did was the original quartet. So Peter Evans on trumpet, John Robigan on saxophone, Kevin Shea on drums, myself on bass, and Ron Stavinsky on piano. We transcribed all of Miles Davis's Kind of Blue note for note, so every cymbal hit and every bass note and every chord voicing, and then we re-recorded it as closely as we could and, you know, released it as our version of Kind of Blue. But inevitably, because of all kinds of factors, it doesn't sound exactly the same, because that's impossible. And the kind of tiny differences in music raise all kinds of questions about history and reality and authenticity and race and class and privilege and education and et cetera.
Well, I tell you, to me, it's not quite that foreign, because, I mean, I'm mostly a folk musician, and sometimes you try to do it exactly the way the original artist did it to preserve that.
Right.
And, of
right.
course, classical music, they're used to playing from scores for centuries.
Right, but those are very different traditions,
right,
doing those things for very different philosophical reasons.
Right.
In that, in the folk music tradition, of which jazz is kind of could be considered part, you've got the idea of trying to preserve an ongoing oral tradition. So you've got like a aspect of the music that cannot or should not be written down, and the way that you preserve that music rather than writing it down or recording it is by learning it and, you know, kind of biologically keeping the music alive, like through your actual physical body. And then in the case of classical music, you've got this kind of historical preservation on the one hand, and on the other hand, the idea that if you're writing very complex notated music, there's no way that everyone would be able to learn their part by ear, so you've got to have some kind of like notation system to convey it. But jazz is neither one of those things, and jazz is this improvised, spontaneous, you know, American music tradition that, you know, arose about 100 years ago in New Orleans and was, you know, perpetuated and developed by the African-American community and then by the wider American community for about a century. And it's got elements of notation and elements of improvisation. But the interesting thing to us about recordings is that even though jazz recordings are these spontaneous creations, they then become these unchanging static things, right? So if you put on the record Kind of Blue, and I'm sure all of your listeners have heard Kind of Blue whether they know it or not, it's the same every time. So even though they were being spontaneous and improvising when they recorded it, it's like it is a studio creation, and it is like a mass-produced kind of object. And so we were approaching that recording as an object, an art object. And so, you know, Miles Davis and Bill Evans and company went into the studio and created this thing that has now, you know, become so ubiquitous you can't avoid it even if you try. And so what started off as this, like, revolutionary improvised music has become this very, like, concrete static thing. And so we wanted to kind of dig at its staticness. And so since it's this unchanging thing, we wanted to kind of get in there and try to recreate the unchangingness of it. if that makes any sense.
Makes sense to me, and I hope it makes cool. sense to the listeners, because as Mappa's been talking with us, you're starting to hear Mostly Other People Do the Killing and their version of Blue and Green from their 2014 CD Blue. Let's turn up the volume a little bit. And that was Mappa Elliott and the Gang, Mostly Other People Do the Killing, doing their version of Blue and Green from their tribute to a Miles Davis classic kind of blue LP that was released in 1959, I believe recorded in 1958, but you guys recorded that back in 2014 after years of work on it.
Yeah, with some of the stuff that you're hearing on there was recorded in 2012 and 2013. It kind of wound up being a little bit of a Frankenstein editing job.
Speaking of Frankenstein, Why do you name so many of your tunes after small towns in Pennsylvania?
Right. Yeah, so years ago, this was also when I was still in college, as an avid jazz listener, it doesn't take very long listening to jazz to realize that jazz song titles have become increasingly irrelevant as the decades have gone on. And so at the time I was listening to a lot of Anthony Braxton, and Anthony Braxton titles his compositions, you know, just like combinations of letters and numbers that represent his kind of mathematical, philosophical, astrophysical philosophy. So I was thinking, okay, well, that's one way to do it, just number your compositions, but I didn't really want to do that. And so I wanted to pick something totally arbitrary that I could use as titles for my songs that I was never going to run out of. And I grew up in Pennsylvania, just outside Scranton, and I'm very aware that Pennsylvania has literally hundreds of absolutely ridiculous town names. So I decided that I would title all of my songs after towns in Pennsylvania. And
like the Shikshinny Shimmy.
Pennsylvania has more incorporated towns than any other state in the United States, so I'm doing all right.
And you are currently, in addition to playing music in New York, you are currently teaching high school?
Yeah, I've been teaching high school for 12 years at this point.
What subject? Music?
Music. Initially, I taught biology, and then I switched over and started teaching music.
Ah, that's that liberal arts education from
Oberlin
College.
That's how it do.
Absolutely. I went to a small school in Ohio, so yeah, right on for Oberlin. I mean, I went to Kenyon.
Right.
But anyway, that's another story. This interview is not about me, it's about you. The last thing we're going to do before we sign off is go to your 2012 release, Slippery Rock. And so this is, again, it got John and you and Kevin and Peter still on it.
Yes.
And I'm picking out a song that is not have the name of a small town in Pennsylvania. At least I don't think so.
Oh, yes, it does.
Is Granny Spry?
There's a town called Spry.
You got me.
Yep, always. I'm consistent, if nothing else. there's a town called Spry, but that is Granny Spry is a quote from the Christmas movie Bad Santa with Billy Bob Thornton.
That's right.
And Bernie Mac. And I really love that movie, and so it was combining two things that I love, absurd towns in Pennsylvania and absurd Christmas movies. So I titled that one Is Granny Spry.
Well, folks, if you get a chance to see mostly other people do the killing, you make sure you go out and catch them, whether they're in Philadelphia, Baltimore, Washington, New York, Wilmington, or wherever they might be. You guys are just a whole lot of fun.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for taking some time out of your Tuesday afternoon. And here comes Is Granny Spry. We'll be right back. We all hope that you enjoyed that interview with Moppa Elliott from Mostly Other People Do the Killing. And Steve Klinge is now here for all tomorrow's parties, so if you want to hear the entire track, Is Granny Spry, you'll need to look for Mostly Other People Do the Killing's record, Slippery Rock. Thanks for listening to WVUD and WVUD HD1 here in Newark, Delaware.